Hey everyone, Tawny here. I am so excited to share that my husband and I launched a non-alcoholic beverage called Parentheses. It's technically two drinks, a before and an after. The before uses herbs that stimulate the senses, and the after uses herbs that calm the senses. Head to drinkparentheses.com and follow us at drinkparentheses. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Recovery Rocks. It's your girl, Tawny, joined by my fabulous BFF.
Lisa, what's up, you guys?
How are you, my love?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And we are joined by a very special guest today, Art Alexakis from the band Everclear. Hello.
Hey, ladies. A lot of girl power, a lot of love in this room. I live a life full of girl power.
Because recovery rocks.
What's yeah. That?
It's because recovery rocks, Art.
It does.
So thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And we would love to hear, we've done all the research. We know that you have, I believe, 35 years of recovery now.
34 years of continuous recovery, of continuous sobriety. My sober birthday is June 15th. So that'll be 35.
Wow. Okay. Congratulations.
Hell yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. I'm a little over 8 years. Lisa is almost 20.
I'll have 20 hopefully next month. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. See, that's how we say it. God willing, hopefully.
Right. Yep. Yeah. All we've got is today. That's for sure. That's all
today, man. And when you embrace that, it makes life so much easier. It really does.
I know.
Hanging fruit. I'm going to be nice. I'm going to be of service. Hey, that dish needs being washed. I'm going to wash it. Hey, you know what I mean?
It's absolutely. Like, yeah. I mean, it just, in a way, it's hard. I always say that program that one day at a time is really the truest of the slogans for me, the thing that totally saved my life. And it makes life easier if I'm not dwelling on yesterday and I'm not thinking and worrying about tomorrow, which is going to take care of itself if I show up today, assuming I show up and take the right decisions today.
Well, exactly. And I think that's you're setting the foundation for tomorrow by what you do today, right? and how you show up. We're saying the same thing. I mean, I read a book when I was going through my last divorce, my third divorce. To be fair, I've been married wife, we've been together for almost 20 years, so
yeah.
So it took me a minute, but I read a book called, two books really helped me, The Four Agreements. I don't know if you guys and you know what, I just started revisiting it. It's pretty wonderful. I mean, I'm getting more out of it the second, third time I read it. But the one book that really helped me was The Power of Now. And by Eckhart Tolle. And his other books, I don't think really, I mean, they were good. He's good. He's smart. He's been through a lot. But that book, I really feel like all the gods converged, it's just like the perfect storm of connection. And at the time, it was perfect for me because it really, really helped me get through heartbreak and depression. And it helped me get back into going to meetings again because I had gotten away from it. There's been periods in my sobriety where I've been what we in the program called dry drunk.
And, right.
I've been there. And
but can you explain that a bit to our listeners who may not know what a dry drunk is? Could you expand on that?
Sure. Dry drunk is when you're not using drugs or alcohol, but you're still acting like an alcoholic.
Yeah.
You're still in your reptile alcoholic mind, make those decisions, and you're holding on to resentments, and you're holding on to jealousies, and you're using anger triggers, and you're basically being an alcoholic without being drunk. And in some ways, I think that's worse. I don't want to say that, but like, it's better to drink. It's horrible to drink if you're an alcoholic. Yeah. But in some ways, it's worse because people assume that you're going to be a certain way. And you're holding this banner, maybe not, you know, like I'm not one of those guys who put pictures of my chips online. I think that goes, you know, the traditions. I don't think it's right. I'm just not one of those guys. I don't have a circle and pyramid tattoo, you know. I don't do that. But I try not to resent other people to do that's their business. But everyone knows I've been open about my recovery for years and years and years, and that this has been something that people have talked about. And I felt disingenuous towards the end of the last time I was dry drunk of not being that guy. And I went through therapy and everything. But once I got back into meetings and working the steps for the second time, like really copiously working the steps for the second time from the beginning, I'm doing it for the fourth time right now.
Oh, wow.
You guys, I'm doing it with the traditions and I'm doing it with the book, the big book.
Wow. Great.
My, what I call my spiritual advisor. And it's just kicking my butt, man. He's getting deep, dark. He's one of those guys that can go, well, on page 56.
It's not just page 417. It's page 56.
He's that guy.
That
guy. Second paragraph, third line. Man, check that out, bro. Yeah, you might. You know, that he's that guy. But doing it with both with my sponsor and with my spiritual advisor, it's taken a while, but man, every step I just feel like I feel like a more full person, you know?
Yeah. And with that comes the relief, right? Comes the ability to live life a little more lightly.
Right. And stay in your, you know, I mean, a lot of people say, you know, I do all male stag. It's just, that's what works better for me. I just do all my things. And thank God in some ways for COVID because it opens Zoom to us. So we can do stuff like this.
Yeah.
And we can do meetings. I do three Zoom meetings a week. I do one to two in-person meetings. If I'm on the road, I try to hit an in-person meeting or even a local Zoom. And I just find it all a blessing. You know, just all this, just good sobriety that's everywhere. I mean, I hooked up with a bunch of guys. I went to a meeting in Perth, Australia about 3 weeks ago.
Nice. And
these guys were knuckleheads, man. They were old school alcoholics, hardcore blue collar, old school alcoholics. You do this, you do not do this. I mean, you know, it's us California alcoholics are like, hey, man, whatever. You know? Yeah. These guys were not playing that game. But it was wonderful. It was just absolutely wonderful. And I did a little bit of my pitch. You know, I did like, I think a 10-minute pitch, which is kind of difficult.
And so we're all three writers. And so like, we wanted to ask you, like, you know, Lisa and I, we've written books and you pour your heart and soul into your lyrics. And so I'm wondering what role recovery plays in your writing process.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I did write before I was sober. All my good stuff, even the stuff before Everclear, all the good stuff is after I had that moment, you know.
Yeah.
I had that moment in 1989. It when I was 27. I think all my lyrics, I think one thing it gives me is more of a less, let's see if I can put the right words on it, less of a bias opinion. I mean, even when I'm like, a lot of people think all my songs are autobiographical because I like storytellers, you know, I like people to tell stories. One of my favorite songs of all time is Bob Dylan, Tangled Up in Blue, where he just tells
a story
about working on a fishing boat, working in the Great North Woods, cooking the Great North. You know what I mean?
That's my favorite Dylan song too.
Revolution in Paris, you know, just you dealing with slaves. Just, I mean, it's just like these lines coming out of nowhere that seem like they don't make a lot of sense, but they just, because it's from the first person and it's that perspective, he creates this character and this voice that, and that's what I try to do. It's like some of my songs, Father of Mine, I Will Buy You a New Life, several others, very autobiographical. Then there's songs like Wonderful and Santa Monica that I take things from my life, but I create a character and a voice of that character, and I create the world around it. A lot of times with my own experiences, sometimes experiences that I've heard or read about or I imagine. And then about another third of my songs are just, I just write stories, you know, Tangled Up in Blue. I just write stories. And I've got a song that is influenced by that called Learning How to Smile. And for hardcore Everclear fans, that's like their favorite song. That's probably one of my, if not my favorite song. And it's one of those songs, you know, talking about drunk on a Greyhound bus and our car broke down in Vegas. And it's just this, and, you know, them working, you know, in Philadelphia, she's working for a, doing phone sex. Remember phone sex?
Yeah.
Throwback.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that was the only fans of the 90s, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Before sexting and OnlyFans. Yeah.
Yep. And Tinder. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I've never been on Tinder. I have no idea. I know theoretically, like I'm watching a TV show right now called Made. Have you guys read that book? Made?
Oh, Stephanie Land.
Stephanie Land.
Yeah.
Have you seen the show?
I haven't. I read the book and she's great. How's the show?
The show's phenomenal. I'm going to go back.
It's on my list. Yeah.
My wife turned me on to it and I'm going to go back. I've got about three more episodes, I think, three or four more episodes, and I'm gonna read the book for sure.
Yeah, it's heavy. She's so good. She has a new book out called Class, about pursuing education without any income and with limited funds, and how difficult it is to get an education in America.
It is, and think of all the kids and all the people that just have it given to them, and they just don't understand how precious it is. It's like, all I wanted to do was play an instrument. I saw the Beatles when I was four, like 1966, the last time they were on Ed Sullivan. And I snuck out of my room. My mom had put me to bed, and, you know, but she left the door open, because I didn't like a total dark room. Still don't. And I heard something, some noise off the TV, and I'm in my like Batman shirt, my DVD, my little tidy whities, you know, and I'm hiding behind the couch, and my mom's there with her big old bouffant hairdo, and, you know, her and my dad having a cocktail on the couch, you know, and I peek around the couch and I see the Beatles playing music, and I hear that music, and it just, I couldn't control my body. I ran to the TV. Jump up and down, and they're laughing, but they didn't get it, because I never wanted to do anything else ever. I went to film school because I love film, and I could do that too. But if you made me choose, it would have been music for sure back in the day.
Yeah. What about like curating a soundtrack for a movie or a show? I feel like that would be no.
I'm a song guy.
I like
that you can put a universe, you can put a lifetime of images and question marks of what came before and what comes after, and you can create this own little bit universe in 3 minutes or 4 minutes. I love it, and I love rock and roll. You know, I've tried to do some stuff and people liked it. It's like scoring like short films and stuff like that. I just don't love it. I like it.
Yeah.
But it's like not really my thing. I don't know.
Fair enough.
That was like 10 years ago. Maybe I should try it again.
You never know. I mean, God, Trent Reznor did the score for the new Watchmen TV show. That was beautiful.
Didn't he do the soundtrack for Social Network?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think he won an Oscar for that, actually.
Well, there you go. And that's impressive because he, like me, doesn't read music. He's not a scholarly guy. Mm. You know, he's just doing it by sound. He's singing the notes, playing it on keyboard, and then having someone transpose it. And that's cool. And if the right project came up, I would jump on it. It would be really cool. But, you know, I'm not out there acting. Yeah. To do that, you really have to play the game and just really put yourself out there and do a lot of work. Like there, these people who do these $15,000, $20,000 horror films like Sharknado and, you know, they're like, yeah, we'd love you to do some soundtracks. I go, cool. Okay. What does it pay? $1,000?
Yeah.
For 2 months worth of work?
What?
I go play a show and blow that out of the water without naming numbers, but just, no. It's just,
yeah.
I got more time. Right now, I'm not rich by anyone's standards, and I have to work and leave a legacy for my family if it gets to the point with my MS that I can't work. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I'll be 62 in about 2 weeks, and you never know. So, but when it comes to stuff like that, I got more time than money, really.
Mm-hmm. That's
taking away time from my family. And
that's real.
Yeah.
I've got a 16-year-old right now who's going through it. I don't know if you guys get it. Yeah, it's rough.
We don't have kids, no, but I remember being a 17-year-old girl and going through it, and it was a lot. I didn't have the tools that I have now.
Were you addictive even then?
I was. I began my self-medication around 14, 15. And I ended up at 17, I actually got expelled from high school. I brought drugs to school and I almost overdosed. Can't bring Xanax to school, turns out.
Not if you're using it as a drug.
No. Right. It was bad. I was like crushing it up and snorting.
Oh, yeah.
Like I was really sick. And I was expelled and sent to an alternative education program. And it was a really dark time.
What city did you grow up in?
So I grew up partly in mostly Waco, Texas, but also we're originally from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay.
And then mom and I relocated to Waco and dad stayed in the Bay Area. So I kind of grew up back and forth, but went to school in Waco.
I can't think of two different worlds more divergent.
Right.
Well, and it's, I told you my dad's a musician. So like he was, you two may have crossed paths. Who the hell knows? He was in a band called Vicious Rumors in the 80s.
I lived in San Francisco in the 80s. Late 80s. That's where I got sober.
Okay. He played at like the Waldorf and, I don't know. I was very, very young, but I was literally going to metal shows like in my infancy. I've always done that. So
is he a metal guy? Your dad?
He is. He's a metal musician. He was a bass player now, and he's taught himself guitar. Now he and his wife have a metal band. So it's, and he has a guitar repair business. So, you know, he hasn't toured in decades, but he's still making music and he's still working in music.
He's doing what he wants to do.
He's doing the thing. And, you know, we have had a very bumpy road. And I know father of mine is, you know, you have newer songs, a very new song that we can talk about. But I just wanted to thank you for writing Father of Mine, because you gave me language and words to understand these feelings that I felt when I think I was 12 when Father of Mine came out. And those lyrics really gave me words to describe how I felt, which then gave me permission to feel how I felt. So I just want to thank you for that.
So you're born in like 85, 86? Yep. Yeah. You know, it that song, it's interesting because that song, I had never meant to write that song, but one night, and you guys don't have kids, but parents, people who have children will respond to this. They always do. One of the things you do when they're younger, and you, especially if you don't have a lot of money, is you just watch your baby sleep. I know it sounds boring to people who aren't parents, but it's kind of magical. And I remember watching my eldest daughter sleep when she was like 5 in 97, and or actually 4. It was 4 in 96, because it was the fall of 96 when we started recording that album. And it's right, so it must have been like late summer. And I just was just wondering, how do you literally, without being snarky, how does a man walk away from that? I don't understand. How does a real man walk away from your own child? That magic right there. And I went to my office. One of the bedrooms of my house, I had an office and guitars and a little recording stuff. And just, I sat there on the couch with my notepad, my guitar. And then I finally went to bed at 5, but I had a song. And wow. Then I tweaked it out. And about 2 weeks after that, I was down in LA at Capitol Records with my A&R guy. And he knew well enough not to ask me for demos, because I don't do demos. And I said that from the beginning. When it was a bidding war, I'm like, I want this much money. I want this. I want this. I want this. And everyone's like, yeah, that's great. And I go, oh, yeah, by the way, I want total creative control on everything. And I produce my own records. And like, poof, 2/3 of the labels just disappeared.
Yeah. Yes.
Went quiet. But Capitol was still there, so that I signed with them. So my A&R guy knew better than to ask. But I'm, you know, he's like, so how's the project going? I'm like, it's going pretty good. I go, I just wrote a song called Father of Mine. You want to hear it? He's like, you know, and if you ask him now, he's like, he almost jumped out of his skin. He's like, yeah. And like, he's playing well, because he's, you know, at the time he's like a 45-year-old Brit, and he's like, sure, Arthur, no problem. Yeah, play it. I picked up this out-of-tune guitar he's got in his office, and I play it all the way through what I got. And, you know, he's very, very British, you know, very just, that's very emotional art. You know, the sound through the door of the office out to the desk where the, you know, what we used to say, call secretaries, where their assistants were, right, out there. And I walk out there, and there's like 4 late young ladies, girls, sitting on the desk outside his office, bawling, just bawling. I mean, not crying.
Yeah.
Just like holding each other. And when I walk out there, my A&R guy is like, well, I don't know if it's a single, but it's definitely going on the record.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And,
yeah.
You know, that was, I realized at that time that that song was bigger than me, that I had tapped into something from my higher power, who I affectionately thought, you know, that was, I'm the vessel for it, that it came through like that. And I felt like that about quite a few of my songs, you know, like, I remember sitting in that room and doing the work and the craft and stuff, but some songs just come really good, and songs that relate to, that are things I can really relate to, like the song Wonderful, you know, watching Otter go through, watching her, my eldest daughter, dealing with me and her mom breaking up and divorcing was really painful to watch, because it triggered me watching my parents do that when I was about the same age, and friends of mine that had gone through it and were going through it as well. So that's where that song came from. But sometimes some of the truth just, you know, I don't think truth has to be, not, nonfiction, you know, or nonfiction. I think truth is truth, and it comes from different places.
That's so real. If I used to not read fiction because I was like, no, I want to know what happened. There's so much history. I need to know what's really happened. And then I got into fiction during the pandemic and I was like, God, there's so much truth in this. Like there's
in
more
stories. Yeah.
There's arguably sometimes more truth in fiction.
Absolutely. Because you can hide it, right?
Yes. Yes. You can disguise it.
You can disguise it. Good one. You can change the names and, you know, the identities, but you can talk about stuff. Like there was a situation that happened to me when I was 8. I was raped by teenage boys, like older. And one of them was basically a man. And I never told anybody. I never told my mom. I never told anybody because I knew I had, you know, being a kid, you know, I'd looked around in my mom's room and I found a gun under her mattress. My mom was from the South, deep South. Mm-hmm. And she would have killed those boys. I knew that. And I would have gotten in trouble for being in that house because she told me not to go to that house. Emphatically, like, smacked me upside the head. You know, that this is the 70s, early 70s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how we did. That's how we did back then.
Yep.
You know, people are like, I couldn't imagine getting spanked. I'm like, really? And they used to hit you in school. They legally could hit you in school.
Yeah. Yeah.
What? A second grade, Miss Allen would hit us with the ruler. And trust me, they hit me a lot. Hit me a lot. You know, we're talking about ADHD. With and a lot of alcoholics and addicts have ADHD because it makes us a lot more predisposed to, you know, dependency and just being addictive, addictive behavior. But they tried to put me on Ritalin when I was 10 or 11, and my mom wouldn't let him. She's like, no, you're not going to give him speed. He's a 10 year old. And they didn't call it ADHD. They called it hyperactivity.
Hyperactivity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was born in 66 and, right. You know, that kid is hyper, that it was very, that was the term. And I have major depressive disorder and I was, you know, which I started treating as a young teen with alcohol and drugs. And, you know, when I would say I was sad or whatever, it was like, I'll give you something to be sad about. You're depressed. I'll give you something to be depressed about. You know, there was no language. So yeah, it was like, hey, cheer up, suck it up.
Suck it up, man. You know, have a drink when you're older.
Have a drink.
Or clever enough to do it without me catching you. Do what you got to do.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, how many maintenance alcoholics have you met in your life?
Oh my gosh, so many.
They go to work every day, never late, never miss a day, work hard every day, get off, hit the bar on the way home, get home for dinner, have drinks after dinner, and that's it.
Pass out. Yep.
You take those drinks away from them, they're going to fall apart. That's not me. I'm the type of alcoholic or addict rather that's just, I describe it to my sponsees as me, 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 more, more, more. And generally it makes me mean, mean, me, you know? It brings out the worst in me.
Yeah.
Triggers that I've developed to protect myself when I was a kid, you know, cause we moved to a really rough neighborhood when I was a kid. And I don't think it was bad. It was just, it was different from what I had lived in. And I got ostracized and I got bullied and I had to learn to fight back.
Yeah. That was,
this isn't the new age now when you bring kids together and you bring the parents in and you talk about it. You know, my brother was across the street going, he's like, if those boys take your lunch money again and you let them without fighting back, I'm going to smack you around. I'm like, And I was
okay, got it.
It's like pick your poison, right?
Yeah. In fact,
way more afraid of my drug addict brother than I was of me.
Yeah.
I remember walking out of the school. I was 8 years old and sunny day, and I could see him sitting on like a lowrider with his Chicano girlfriend, just, you know, and he's like, if I was 8, why is he like 15? But he already looked, man, you know, he'd already like 2 or 3 times. And I remember him pointing at me, and I'm just like, and this little kid goes, hey, and I just started hitting kids. And the next thing I know, the principal came and picked me up and by the scruff of the neck. And that was the end of that. And I got suspended, but no one ever messed with me again.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is you got sober at a young age.
27.
Relatively. Yeah, which I got sober at 38. Young. And I think
29.
But you were very much, in a place where everything was around you. What would you say to someone young like that, first coming in, who thinks, because I run into this a lot, and I think Tawny does too, where we meet people who are like, it's just what everybody does. I can't not do it. I won't fit in. I won't be able. I mean, to me, your story has so much humility in it, and giving back. And you've done all these amazing things sober. How would you, if a young person came up to you at a meeting and said, what advice have you got for me?
Well, you know, I, for one thing, advice is a dicey thing, right?
Right.
It's like, I can eat my own cooking, no problem. I love the way I cook, but that doesn't mean that person or that person is going to enjoy the way I spice things up and tell things. And you know what I mean?
It's a weird. Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah.
Right. So my advice is usually when I talk to people, it's just like, you need to figure out if you're powerless.
Oh, yeah.
You need to get step one on it.
That's where the humility comes in, too. Yeah.
That and step two, the humility, is just where you just need to, like, when I had my day of reckoning on June 15th of 1989, I was married to my first wife. We were in San Francisco living in the Upper Haight, and I was working downtown in an office. And I had, for about 2 years, and it got more and more and more, just started blacking out. I don't know if either of you ever did that, but. Mm-hmm.
Since I was 15, yeah.
Yep.
But I would disappear for days.
Oh, yeah.
Wake up bruises and like my knuckle when I've been in fights. And people would tell me, man, yes, I am Friday night. Man, you're in a weird space. You're with some chick. And I'm like, yeah, I don't remember it, man. And so I remember leaving work early because I didn't feel good. Why? Because I was probably super hungover. Stopping at a bar up in Knob Hill, getting off the bus, and walking in this old bar. But I know a lot of punk rockers would go in that bar. And there was these two punk rock tattooed girls sitting at a table smiling at me. And I'm like, walked over there. And then that's all I remember. That's all I remember. And then I woke up. That was Wednesday evening. And I woke up Sunday morning in my bed, in mine and my wife's bed, in our apartment, in bed with this girl who I found out later was a prostitute. And my wife was sitting on the floor like 5 feet away. With her head in her hand. And that was the worst. That was the bottom. I had the bottom. But when I talk to people and I'm like, I gotta know, you gotta know if you're done.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
You gotta be done. I don't care how much money you spend, it's become a cottage universal industry, and it's like $40,000 a day to go to Sarah, for $10,000 a day or some crazy stuff like that. I got sober in the rooms, I got sober in the rooms. I didn't go to rehab, and I was a hardcore alcoholic, hardcore drug addict. But everything works different for different people. But I'm just like, people need to figure out if they're done or not. I was done. I woke up, saw my wife there, got the girl up, got her dressed, took her downstairs, put her in a car, a cab, went up to my wife and said, I'm going downtown. There was this guy I'd met 2 weeks earlier. I was in a record store down in the Galleria, and this guy was looking at me, and I'm just kind of ignoring him. And finally, I walk up to him and go, do you got a problem? Can I help? He goes, I'm sorry, I was staring. I go, I'm great, dude. You know, he goes, no, so am I. He goes, you remind me a lot of me. I go, you look younger than me. What are you talking about? He goes, no, you remind me of me 5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I go, okay, I'll take the bait. What happened 5 years ago? He goes, I got sober. I go, Now, to preface this, since 1985, this is 89, I had been in and out of the rooms when I was living in LA, going to meetings, lying, taking dirty chips, which means you're saying that you're sober, but you're not.
Right.
You know you're not. That's called a dirty chip. And we get chips to signify how long you've been, you know, sober. And it's a big deal. And it's a big deal to lie about it. So I had been going on this thing, going in and out of the rooms. And then finally, this guy, he goes, you know, and I go, you think I'm an alcoholic? And I'm thinking, thank you. Finally, someone said something.
Oh, gosh, I know that feeling. Yeah.
And he's like, no, I don't think you're an alcoholic. I pretty much know you're an alcoholic. Dude, it's 11 o'clock in the morning. Your hands are shaking. You're sweating. What, you got a you got the flu?
Yep.
I go, look, thanks, man. I appreciate it, but not interested. And he goes, here's my number. Give me a call. If you ever want to go to a meeting, I'll take you to a meeting. And it said Michael, and it had a number. And I took it, and I walked to the door, and I turned around. And I saw him there, and he waved at me. And I waved at him and ripped it up, threw it in the trash. At him, and I just said, fuck you. And I walked. Right? So 2 weeks later.
2 weeks later, right.
I'm in the cab after this just hitting bottom and just shaking, really shaking. The DT is really bad. And headed downtown, hoping he's there, right? And for some reason, he's there opening up because it's before 11 and they open at 11 on. And I knock on the door, and he comes over. I go, you remember me? He goes, yeah, man, you're Art. I'm like, you're Michael, right? And he goes, yeah. And I go, you told me that you'd take me to a meeting if I thought that I couldn't, you know, because he asked me to step on. He's like, hey, are you powerless? If you decide you're powerless. Mm. I go, I feel like I might be powerless, you know, hedging my bet still. I might be powerless. And he's like, well, cool, dude. You know what? I get off, come back. We'll go to a meeting tonight. I go, fuck that. You told me you'd go to a meeting. I'm here. I need to go to a meeting right now. And the guy's just like looking at me. He's like, he turns around to the gal who's behind the counter. He goes, I'm going to take today off.
I love that. Yeah.
The three meetings. And in the third meeting, by the third meeting, I had that white light moment of just, is there anyone new here? And I just stood up and started talking. And I just realized that I'm powerless. And it's the first time I'd ever said it in minutes. And my name's Art, and I am an alcoholic. Just bawling. And all these people I've never met before just put their hands on me and just reassuring and loving. And I just had this white light, what we call a white light God moment, God shot, where it just like, it was just, that was it.
It's amazing.
and I never saw it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for, thank you so much for sharing. That is like, really, like you just said, like what you would tell someone who is, you know, newly sober or debating is like, ask for help. You
and
know,
are you done
feeling this shitty? Like, thank you for that.
Or be threatening and demand help.
Yeah, that works too.
Yes.
But you know what? I never saw that guy again until about 3 months later in a meeting. I saw him across the room and he was sitting there smiling at me and he had the book and he just did it like that. Like, I'm just like, thank you. Then I watched speaker, and then after they said something, people were laughing. I was looking at people, I looked over at him and he's gone. And I never saw him again.
Oh, wow. He got sent. He got sent.
What if he's listening?
Bring you in.
Yeah. He's listening right now.
Michael.
Thanks, Michael. Art, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And I know you've got a tour. You guys are touring and you have a new song. Is there anything that you wanted to kind of? Yeah. Okay.
Put out a live album, Everclear Live at the Whiskey at Go-Go, last September. And there's two new songs on there, like studio recorded songs, one called Year of the Tiger, which is very political, and then another song called Sing Away, which was a solo record. It's an acoustic song, but this is a pretty heavy rock version of, you know, Everclear version. Yeah. And it's about teenage bullyism and suicide.
Oh, and wow.
Things I haven't gone through, but I've had people do, you know, a lot of people around me have died. My daughter got bullied. Both my daughters gotten bullied. I got bullied in the day of, we live in an age where, you know, just they're out there. The jackals are out there and they're, you know, they're online and they just say horrible things.
Oof.
And when you have low self-esteem and ADHD and OCD and depressive disorder, anxiety disorder, and all that stuff, you're sitting duck for that kind of predator violence. And so I wrote that song, and it's we still play it. We play it. It's, I wouldn't call it our new song. I'm working on a new song right now. I can't really tell you about, but
yeah,
a new song, because I don't really want to make a record. I just want to record like a new. Yeah. A year, something for the fans, something to play, and something that I can make like a cheap video for, you know, like we did a video for Sing Away, and the boy who plays the protagonist in it is great, and my daughter plays his she's cute,
but, very cool.
Other than that, we're touring in the fall. We got shows every weekend now, flyaway dates. We do about 50 to 60 of those a year. And then we got 30, 35 shows in the fall that we're doing a tour with Marcy Playground, our good friends of Marcy.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And another band from the 90s that had a couple of hits, Jimmy's Chicken Shack. So we're doing that, and that's going to be fun. And that's going to be celebrating 25 years of the making of our album, Songs from American Movie Volume 1. And so a few songs off that we don't normally play. So that'll be fun. And then next year in 2025, that'll be the 30th anniversary of our first major label record, Sparkle and Fade, which had Monica and Heroin Girl and stuff like that. So that's what we got going on. I'm working on my memoir.
Yes.
And working on my life coaching practice. I'm a certified master life coach in sobriety, creative, and just regular life coach. So I've got a few clients now, but I'm working on doing some stuff to do more stuff online to connect with people. Because I really feel like you can bring a lot of the principles from the book into normies that have other issues.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know why anybody hasn't really done it yet. You know, you don't have to. We who are in AA, we don't use that word. We don't talk about that. You know, that's the traditions. If you want to talk about your own recovery, you can do that. You can't talk about anybody else's.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's real. I mean, I don't come from the 12-step world. My recovery is, you know, yoga and therapy and various other things, but I very much relate to the tenets of, like, you know, one day at a time. It's every single day. And my book is written through the sober curious lens. People are really interested in sober dating, even if they are still drinking. There's a dry dating trend right now where people are just removing alcohol from their sex and dating relationships.
Really?
Yeah, I'll email you my book. I'll email you the PDF.
Wouldn't you want someone whose defenses are down that's had a few drinks? I mean, really?
I mean, however we could sneak in the vegetables, right? Like, let's show them how good it can be. That's how I look at it.
Okay. I like that.
And thank you so much for hanging out with us today, Art. And if, you know, we've both written books. So if you need any help,
I think he's got it covered.
Just saying, it's a weird world. Publishing's a weird world.
It is a weird world. I might hit you up on that. I might just ask you to read a few pages too. We'll see.
I'd be honored. Thank you so much for hanging out, Art, and sharing your story with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, thank you both. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks, Art.
Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. You can find my blog, sobrietyparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at lisasmithadvisory.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.